happening now is streamed online. So there's a kind of triple connection we're having. You can probably, if you watch the stream, see the kind of seed circulate. So, welcome. I present to you Michael Terry. He's in Waterloo in Canada, at home right now. And I invited him to be present at this in this unusual way, because it seemed almost the best way to present a project that allows users to map their movement through software. So as a result, I'm sitting here with, let's say, completely wired with plugs and electricity and cameras and everything, to talk to Michael about the project he heads, which is called InGIMP, and with as a subtitle, Instrumented GIMP. GIMP is the free software image editor that it has been around for quite a while, and it's been used with love, but also with hate, I think. People are either completely a fan of its kind of different interface, or keep complaining that it doesn't look like the software they're used to. I don't know, we have to ask Michael whether that was a reason to actually start with this project on InGIMP, or why this was. But what they've done, and I'll just demonstrate you, because I've installed it on my computer, what it does. So I'll, this is something you can't see, unfortunately, Michael, but you know what it does, I guess. What I've done is I've installed a special version, I think it's called, you could say, of the image editor, which will allow the research group to look into my gestures through this software. So if I open an image editor, I can choose for normal GIMP or for GIMP image editor instrumented version. Once I open the project, I'm presented already with a quite an interesting screen. You can see it, yes. Because it tells me clearly I'm not entering my normal session, I'm entering an instrumented version. And the first thing it asked me to do is to give an activity tag, which is what, in effect, answering the question, what do you want to do? So I've been resizing images a lot, so let's keep going there. But it gives me immediately also the possibility to not go into GIMP itself, but to look at the results of other users. So I'm at the same time, I'm immediately linking my own use to the use of others. So I'm launching it. And from that moment on, I actually have no sense of that there's something different. I can open, I don't know, an image maybe. I don't know. I have no images here. If I open this, that will take a while. I can open an image. I can move through it. I can edit it. I mean, GIMP works as if nothing has changed. I don't know what it is, but well, let's look at this one. This is quite interesting image of crushing CDs in China. So I can walk through this image and decide to save or not save or revert or I don't know. And at the moment I quit in GIMP, it will send the data to a central server. I guess it's in Waterloo, no? Where is it actually? Where is it stored, the traces? Do you know that? Doesn't hear me now. All of us can actually look at then our communal use. So I'll show you the site. Sorry, it takes a while. So there's a site that shows all the traces of all the users that have this InGIMP installed. So again, I can see how long someone else takes to open a certain menu bar, to move from one tool to another. But also I can see, for example, these activity logs the kind of tags people have given to the task they undertake. That's the network is a bit slow, so I'll just, I won't look into this for too long, because I might lose the connection. Try it out yourself, because it's quite interesting experience, actually, to read your behavior through this kind of data. And I think Michael will tell us about how they, for example, had to work on ways to, at the one hand, get as much data as possible, but at the same time, make sure that users would not be revealed. Because you can imagine that through viewing this data, you could also recreate a movement. You could recreate the image I was working on. You could recreate the text I was pasting in. So it's important, of course, to know exactly where you need to save traces and where you need to forget about them. So, Michael, we're back to you. Hello. So would you want to, I presented it in my way from my user experience. Could you, I can open the document you sent me. Could you talk us through this particular software?
Sure. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, hello. Hello. Yes. Yeah, I tried to show you as well. Okay, yes. This is interesting. Talk about... yes. Yeah, that's a good one. Yes, people nod.
Thank you. software isn't sometimes hidden, right? There aren't these public, publicly visible traces of how the software is being used, okay? I think it's important to distinguish between two types of data we can talk about when we look at the software. Where this is using, where is the software designed to be using? Where is it difficult to learn how to use? Where are there inefficient workflows? Where are there missing features, and so on? That's traditionally what we think about when we talk about usability data. Now, the kind of data I'm going to be talking about today is what we call usage data, which is different from usability data, but complements it. Right? So how are people actually using the software in the wild? Right? So often when you talk about usability, you bring people into a laboratory setting, a control laboratory setting, they use the software for some representative tasks, and you can identify potential usability flaws, okay? But this is different from people's actual experiences in the wild, you know, when they're using it in their home, when they're using it in the business place. How are they actually using it? Okay? How long are they using it for what kind of tasks? So this usage data helps us quantify the impact of design flaws or new changes or just aspects of the design, overall design, okay? And it can help prioritize efforts. So if we were to know that most of the users use GIMP for painting, well, that suggests that maybe we should spend more time on that aspect of the design. On the other hand, if most people are using for really small images, they're doing things like designing logos for web pages, or essentially prioritize efforts in that approach. Okay? But without this data, a lot of...
Oh, please. Oh, this is... Okay. I don't know. Sorry, we're losing you once in a while now. Yes. Of course. Oh. Okay. Well, we have to call again then. Let's call again. We'll just try again. Oh. Too. I also have to tell you that I'm using a beta version of Skype to... Okay. Oh. So? Try again. Now, well... Just when it was all going well. Okay, try one more time. And then maybe we can gather questions. So when we manage to make the connection again. Then we can ask them. Call refused. Now, what's that? Yes. Okay. We lost you there for... It's a long way from here to Canada.
It's
so,
a long way, but you know where it's faster than if I flew there.
That's true. That's totally true. And you don't have your jet lag.
Okay, so can we get to slide 8?
Slide 8, yes. There we are. Speculation. Yes, we can.
Okay, so the basic issue again is that we really don't know how the software is being used in practice, by whom, on what types of systems, and so on. Okay? And so you see a lot of speculation online, and this is great. I mean, GIMP is one of the pieces of software that people love to hate because it has so much functionality, but they like to argue so much about how it should be redesigned. But if you look at some of the things that people talk about, one of the questions that continually arises, one of the issues that continually arises, is the design of the windows. So should you have every tool palette director of Nathan Pepper window. So this is the way they do it right now. If you look at Photoshop, Photoshop has one closing window for everything. And some people really prefer this. But when you get into arguments about this online, people say things like, well, there is a switch to a dual block setup, and it is obvious that this is what the game was designed for. You can throw all the control windows onto one monitor and then flash screen the image on the other. Okay? Another person says the floating separate windows can be handy in the multi monitor setup. The third person says floating crap works much better on multiple monitors. Okay? So there's a lot of speculation that, you know, the current design is just really, you know, well suited to multiple monitors. But we really don't know how many people have these multiple monitor setups. Again, because we just don't have traces of how people use the software. Okay? So let's go on to slide 9. So what really motivated this work was that open source projects lack the infrastructure for collecting this type of data. Commercial software companies do this all the time. Microsoft does it, for example. Web applications do this. Slowly, we're starting to see these kind of tools in the open source community. So things like Smolt, Debian, Popularity Concept, these collect some data about users' computing environments, right? So what kind of operating system they're running, what packages they have installed, and so on. But we don't have any information about how the software is actually being used in practice. Okay, so this is where Anthony comes in, that Femke demonstrated to you. Let's go on to slide 10. So Indian is an instrumented version of AMP. You can go to www.indian.org to download it. And really what we're trying to do is reveal, we're trying to basically hold a mirror up to the community to understand how they use the software in practice. Okay? It's a snap and replace for games and music you play for it. And it's the first example of open instrumentation. And I'll talk about open instrumentation next. So slide 11. So we collect data about how the software is being used, and then all this data is made publicly available. Anyone can view and download and analyze the collected data. The instrumentation itself is open. Okay? Anyone can inspect the source code to see exactly what kind of data we collect. So it's a very transparent process. Okay? But it creates new challenges and opportunities for instrumentation that I'll talk about moving forward. Let's go to slide 12. So there are two major components to this effort. The first is the actual application that's instrumented, and then it's operating. There's a website where you can go and view the statistics, all the data, that we've collected thus far. So you see that in the screenshot right here. Okay, next slide. So here's we have some basic graphs of how people are using the software, where we start to get a reflection of how people are using it. We start to get traces of actual software usage. Okay, so we can see things like in the top left, image width versus image height. And we notice that most people are working with fairly small images, those who are using Indian. So already we start to get a picture of how the software is being used. The top right, we see how many layers are being used in images. And so they're predominantly people have very few layers, right? So it doesn't look like there's a lot of sophisticated use widespread. Right? There are some people who have images with lots of layers, which suggests more sophistication, but by and large, people are working with images with very few layers. And if we look at the bottom left, we see a histogram of when people are actually using it during the day. You see in the afternoon, it seems to have the most frequent usage. And so what this suggests is that people aren't necessarily using this day in and day out and, during business hours, right? They're not going in 9 o'clock in the morning and starting up. It seems to be much more sort of a casual kind of use. And then the final one, the number of hours that people actually use it. If people are using the software mostly for an hour or less. Okay? So we're seeing a picture of the community where they're much more casual, they're much more sporadic. They're not using it for hours on end. So we're starting to get these traces of how people are using the software in the wild. Okay, next slide. So yes. 14.
Yes.
Okay. So, we have this speculation of, multiple monitors is better, setup for GIMP. But we have a question of, well, how many people actually do this? Well, now we can start to answer this question. So about 96% of users of GIMP have a single monitor setup, right? So this notion that multiple monitors is superior given GIMP's current design doesn't really, apply strongly to the current user community. Most of them have every single module set up. And if you look at the resolutions, they're fairly small, right? So we have 1024 by 768, 1280 by 1024. These are the most common module resolutions. And right now, currently, about 90% of the users are Windows users. Now, this might be a reflection of how easy it is to install Windows versus Linux. Packages, we have some packages for some Linux distributions, but we don't have packages for every Linux distribution, so that might be a barrier. But still, we're starting to get some very concrete data about how people, what type of computing environment people have to run Gamepen. Okay? So let's go on to, let's skip to 15, and let's go right on to 16. So we collect five different types of data. We collect system characteristics, so the type of operating system you're running, the number of monitors you have, monitor position. We collect command usage, so what command you use. Anytime you modify your image in any way, we record what command you just applied. We collect interface events, so when you move a window, when you resize a window, we have a sense of how people are spreading the information out across their monitor. We collect information about the document, right? So how big are the images? How big are the images? How many layers are they using? We also collect histograms of images, so basically counting the number of pixels from dark to light. And you can see in the bottom right, we have two histograms there. The top histogram, you see just three spikes, basically, where below it, you see, this much more varied distribution of color intensities for that particular image. Now we collect these histograms representing the images, and then we can tell, okay, so the top histogram there probably reflects line art, right? So someone who is using just a few colors, drawing something from scratch, whereas the bottom histogram indicates that the person is probably working with a photograph. So we not only see how they move about the application space, how they move about the task, but we also get a sense of what types of images they are working on without actually looking at the actual images. And then finally, as Femke showed, we have activity tags. So if we go on to the next slide, 17, when you start up Gamepen, it asks you what you plan on doing with the software. So people can characterize in their own words how they plan on using the software. And this, if you go to the website, you can look at all the activity tags. They're very interesting. You see a lot of varied uses of the software. And you also see people trying to, be funny or like communicate back to us, saying, I'm just doing this, ignore my log right here. Or they can get very, very detailed as well about what they plan to do. So they're working on an image for Wikipedia, for example. So it's a really interesting look into how they think they're going to be using.
Wait a second, I think I have downloaded one of these so I can show it, because I think it's interesting to see. Oops, sorry. There we go. So this is the list you can download. So you see the amount of times people have filled in certain activities. But also how it's the kind of descriptions, how people describe what they're doing, what they describe, is quite an interesting list of activities.
Right. A lot of variation.
Okay, back to you.
Okay. So let's move on to slide 18. So one of the things to know is that Gamepen is a fork of the official distribution, okay? And so one of the hurdles that we have to overcome is to convince people to use our version as compared to the official version. Because when you think about it, our version is not providing, significantly different functionality compared to the official version. In fact, we want to have as few reminders there as possible so that you continue using the software as normal. Right. So one of the things we have to do is motivate people to use the software, so we created personalized and personal statistics. So if we go on to slide 19. So when you first start up the application, you have that button there to go to the website directly to see the statistics. Uh, that button also provides you the capability to see the statistics for your usage of the software compared to the rest of the community. So it's not just this personal face to all the data that's being collected. We put a very personal face on it. You can see the most popular commands being used by the community alongside your most frequently used command.
So you have people going at... No, sorry, I was just wondering whether people were competing of doing things the fastest way or the slowest.
So, I don't know if the statistics that we have up there right now really allow for that kind of competition. So some people have asked, you know, are you afraid of people gaming the system or trying to have these competitions like I'm the most frequent user or I'm the most, you know, I have the longest user sessions or anything like that. We haven't looked at the data in detail, but I'm not too concerned about it. I mean, it's, you know, people want to compete on just about anything, but so far we don't have any real evidence that people have been trying to do this. But people like to, what we found is that people really like this level of personalization. You know, again, it puts a more personal face on these traces that are being collected. So if you go to slide 20, so I know this is something that I asked about, and I'd be happy to talk more about these in detail. But another thing that we do is we create an online persona. So every person who uses the software, we dynamically generate a character that represents their usage of the software. So you can think of this as a personal information visualization. And you can see an example of a persona on the right there. Okay? So if we go on to the next one, slide 21, you can see a larger version. So these personas, in their right hand, they hold the most frequently used tools that they use, the most frequently used types of tools. So you see a pencil, you see a T there, you can see an X-Acto knife, you see a paint bucket, and these obviously correspond to tools within the application itself.
What is that? Is that a...
In the left hand.
There's a wound on his head or something. Something went wrong, or...
Yeah.
That's when someone makes a lot of mistakes. Okay.
Right. So, you know, one of the things we do is we bring people in and we observe them as they use the software to understand how their high-level activity, you know, their high-level work can correlate or correspond to the actual data that we collect. And one of the things we found is that with one of the sessions, this user would repeatedly duplicate a document and then immediately close it. And she kept doing this throughout the session. And, you know, we talked to her about it. Well, why are you doing this? She said, well, in Photoshop, to deselect a selection, you hit Control V. But in GIMP, when you hit Control V, you repeat the entire document. So from that activity of them duplicating the document and then immediately closing it, we can determine with a pretty high level of accuracy that the person is likely to Photoshop. Right. And so we put a bandage on the head of the person to know the fact that they're banging their head into the circuit, not to move what they wanted to. In their left hand, we see a canvas, and the canvas depicts the type of tasks that they were performed. You can see the canvas is a mix of text and of images. So this is why the person does graphic design has a task. We look at a canvas for the canvas is all the size according to the relative size of the unit that they work on. So if you go to the next one, slide 22. Back up to slide 21. There's one more thing. There's a tie. The person is wearing a tie to compare the fact that they are using the software mostly during the business hours.
And work, you wear a tie, no?
And we're looking for these stereotypical icons to represent in different classes of use. So if you look at slide 22, you see that there's a different tool set there, and then a camera hanging around the persona's neck, which is basically mostly doing, this user mostly uses the software for photo manipulation tasks. Little thing, you see a string of small images indicating that they work primarily with small images of a relatively small file. So those are things sort of, you know, like
book on her and a wallet picture.
Slide 23. So, one of the nice things about being able to create these responses is we learn how people use the software, because we can't really almost literally pull up mirrors to the community, right? So, as close as we can take a snapshot of the entire community of GC users. So, this snapshot you see right here was taken, I think, in August or before September, and there were about 600 people there. And so, you can see, you know, these are the number of people who saw that. And they're not organized in clusters, you know, per task, something we'd like to look into. But we think it's sort of a nice idea where we can put up a more personal face, a more community, that communal face on the activity, right? So you're actually part of something larger.
Can I ask you something? Do you have an API or something to work on these images? Because I can imagine that GIMP users would be really good in, let's say, making their own representations of the kinds of types of use they're involved in. Or would that be interesting, let's say? Because I understand it's
I think it would be interesting. So, we have sort of a plan of things that we'd like to do in the future. One of the things that we'd like to do at some time is just open up the API that we have for creating these perspectives, so that if other projects want to use them, they could. I think it would be interesting to open up the community. One of the things that we have to think about is, you know, what types of representations people might put out there, and, you know, if there could be some representations that might be undesirable.
I'm asking the question, of course, because let's say you can say undesirable, but it's also desirable. Because I think as image maker, your users are mainly image makers, so that I think they're pretty aware of, let's say, how they would like to be represented. And it would be quite interesting to look at use both through text, collected data, and through the kind of images that people would put back into the system. I think, of course, there will be, the casual user that puts in, I don't know what, but it could be interesting also from not only from creating a user community or more strong